and layered like a flaky golden pastry from a Parisian bakery. Her inspiration had been the legendary Tarte Philippe, a delicious confection, far more delicious than other desserts. In fact, it is the most delicious dessert ever invented. The bodice was a deep green silk, embroidered with gold thread and fitted snugly around her waist. Fur cuffs edged each long emerald sleeve, and the cape of thick red velvet fell from her shoulders like, well, a curtain. It cascaded to the ground and swirled elegantly about her feet. A tiara sparkled upon her head, and the emerald ring glittered on her hand. The ring was key. She could claim to be royalty, and no one would question it, as long as she wore that ring. "Now, I shall put my theory to the test," she thought. Outside the theater, dozens of carriages were lined up at the curb. She chose the most elegant among them and lingered nearby, waiting for its owners to approach. They were a handsome middle-aged couple, very prosperous-looking. The lady wore a long fur coat, the gentleman a gleaming silk top hat. He inclined his head toward his companion and spoke excitedly in Russian. The lady laughed in answer.
"A marvelous performance,"
Penelope interjected as they passed by. She spoke in poshly accented English. She did not care if her words were understood. Her accent, dress, and jewelry would be doing the talking for her. The couple looked at her, uncertain. She fluttered a hand toward them as if waving to her subjects. At the sight of the emerald ring, their puzzled expressions disappeared, and they began fawning on her shamelessly, for surely this was an English princess on holiday.
"Yes, it was magnificent,"
the lady replied in crisp English. Her companion bowed low.
"My lady, do us the honor to share our carriage. Let us drop you at your hotel. Where are you staying?"
In a perfect imitation of Lady Constance Ashton, Penelope let out a trilling laugh.
"The finest hotel in St. Petersburg, of course."
"The Grand Hotel, of course. There is no other like it in the world,"
the man exclaimed. He waved off their coachman so that he might personally help Penelope into the carriage. During the short ride, they pressed many invitations upon her to parties, to the opera, to the spectacular dacha of a wealthy male friend, a very eligible bachelor. But Penelope said no, as she was leaving town quite soon, family business, she explained.
"Back to England, then," the gentleman declared. Jovially, he added, "The work of royalty is never done, eh?"
He seemed to be fishing for some clue as to her title, rank, and connections. Penelope merely smiled. The Grand Hotel surely lived up to its name. It was the length of a city block and could have easily been mistaken for a palace. Penelope's dazzled companions insisted on walking her through the lobby. It was good manners, true, but also they wanted to be seen with her. They kept swiveling their eyes this way and that to discover who in St. Petersburg society might notice them with their new royal friend and start some fantastic rumor as a result. When at last they bade her farewell at the reception desk, Penelope did not say thank you. Instead, she dismissed them coolly with a nod, as if she had done them a favor by gracing them with her presence, even for a short while. After they had gone, she addressed the clerk. Carelessly, she laid her hand upon the desk to show off the emerald ring, and she spoke in the most imperious tone she could imagine.
"I require a room, if you please."
"You shall have our finest, my lady."
The clerk was goggle-eyed at the jewel.
"Under whose name shall I put your account?"
"I would prefer not to say whose name, so as not to draw attention to myself," she replied. "But if you must know, I am a close cousin of my nation's queen. You may put the room charges to her account, but I would prefer you did not gossip about it, sir."
"Your nation's queen?" He looked puzzled. "Do you mean..."
"Queen Victoria, yes, of course," she said, nearly yelling. "The Queen of England, though I have no wish to make that publicly known," she gave him a withering look. "I do hope you are trustworthy, sir. It is so difficult to hire trustworthy employees. My father, the Duke of, Well, I would rather not mention what he is the Duke of, so as not to draw attention to myself. Let me just say that my father complains about the help most bitterly. His master of hounds is afraid of dogs. His steward cannot recall the multiplication tables. It is a frightful inconvenience.
I think I know your father, the clerk blurted. Is he the Duke of Derby?
He very well may be, she snapped. Now, find me a room at once. I have had an exceedingly long day.
It was a curious feeling to carry on with absolutely no concern for other people. To say there was no fun in it would be untrue. On the other hand, she had no wish to make it a habit.
I warn you, sir, I can be a stickler when it comes to my accommodations. I imagine you know the story of the princess and the pea.
No, my lady, he squeaked in fear.
Well, never mind, she said, realizing her error.
Telling a story to better explain her meaning was something a governess would do, and at the moment she was no governess. Great royal ladies did not seek to be understood. They sought to be obeyed.
Have fresh flowers brought in first thing, she commanded. I cannot bear to rise from bed without fresh flowers in the room. And chocolates.
Yes, my lady.
This kind of talk seemed not to surprise him at all.
Fresh flowers and chocolates. I hope our royal suite will please you.
He jotted it all on his pad.
How long will you be staying with us?
Regrettably, I cannot stay long, she said.
And she did regret it, for it seemed a shame to spend only one night in such a marvellous place.
I must return to England as soon as possible, find out what vessels sail tomorrow, and book my passage on the first one to leave.
This was the whole point of her plan, of course. She intended to obtain passage to England without having to pay a single kopeck, all by impersonating a lady of great wealth and royal relations. That those who were most able to pay their way were the least likely to be asked to was ironic, to be sure. Imagine if she had appeared at the Grand Hotel in her plain brown governess's dress and demanded a royal suite charged to Queen Victoria's account. She would have been shown the door at once. For now, at least, the hotel clerk was convinced.
As you wish, my lady. One passage to England, first ship out. I shall confer with the harbour master. Will you require anything else?
When she opened her mouth to answer, it nearly blossomed into a yawn. The clock that hung on the wall said it was nearly 11:30, an alarmingly late bedtime for Miss Penelope Lumley, but just another night at the ballet for a cousin of Queen Victoria.
I would like a pot of strong tea, she replied. A small box with tissue paper in it, and a trusted messenger, for I have an important errand that must be taken care of right away.
The princess's ring had performed brilliantly. Now she would have it delivered to the general's house by midnight, as promised. The Babushkinovs were late risers, and she had already told them she would spend the night at the St. Petersburg home for poor bright governesses. By the time they realized their own governess was not coming back, she would be out to sea, on her way home, at last.
Tea, certainly. Messenger right away. All expenses to be charged to the account of Victoria, Queen of England.
The hotel clerk muttered as he wrote it all down,
including your passage to England.
She glanced him with a small, royal smile.
Of course. I know my cousin will be grateful for your service.
At this, the man blushed and stammered so much he could barely find the key to the royal suite, but at last he did. The messenger was already waiting. Penelope stole a final glance at the emerald ring before tucking it safely into the box and handing it over with her instructions.
The true value of such objects is their beauty, which can never be gambled away, she thought, watching the man go. Still, I wish the captain good luck with his angry general.
In that moment, despite all that had happened, she finally did think of the unhappy Babushkinov family with something like forgiveness. Possibly it was because she was too tired to be cross, and would soon be leaving Russia in any case. Or perhaps kindness and forgiveness were so much a part of her nature that they kept popping to the surface, like one of those cheerful yellow bath duckies they have nowadays. They can be held underwater by force, but their true nature is to float, and they will always find a way to do so when given the chance.
Yes,
I wish them all the best of luck." She fought back another yawn and was grateful she had any sort of bed to sleep in that night. "May they learn that their family can be as happy or unhappy as they choose to be."
The ninth chapter. A messenger is blamed, but fairly. And that is how Miss Penelope Lumley, once a poor bright female and later a lowly governess in a grand house, attended the Imperial Russian Ballet from a seat closer than any royal box and spent a night in the finest suite of the most luxurious hotel in St. Petersburg. St. Petersburg, the capital of all of Russia, a city known for its opulence. The sleepy pretend princess was escorted to her rooms by a fleet of crisply dressed bellboys and hotel maids. They offered to hang up her clothes, close the drapes, open the windows, turn down the bed, pour champagne, run a hot bath, and so on. But Penelope dismissed them all with a bleary-eyed wave. Alone at last in the royal suite. In other circumstances, she could have spent hours admiring the fine antiques, the priceless art, and even the jewel-encrusted eggs lined up proudly in a gilded cabinet, a royal chicken coop for some very unusual chickens. So much of the decor was plated in gold, it was as if King Midas himself had been guest here and carelessly laid his hands on everything within reach. At the moment, however, Penelope's only wish was to wrestle herself out of that absurd outfit and into her own plain flannel nightdress before nodding off. She laid the gown neatly over a stunning Louis XV's gilt wood armchair that would nowadays be in a museum. She removed her tiara and placed it on the head of the gold-leafed marble cherub that served as one of the bedposts.
"I shall wear my royal costume again in the morning, to board whatever magnificent ship bound for England the clerk has booked passage on," she thought, giving the cherub a fond pat on the cheek. The stone child's face looked a bit like Cassiopeia when she was sleeping. "And I must remember to be rude and bossy for the whole voyage. Truly, acting a part is a great deal of work. Perhaps it grows easier with practice. I will have to ask Simon about it. When I get home." In this sleepy but optimistic spirit, she climbed into the high, wide bed, slipped between sheets of pure satin, and laid her head on a pillow stuffed with eiderdown. This was no princess and the pea type situation. The mattress was soft as a cloud, and the bed's exhausted occupant slept so deeply and so well that no dreams dared disturb her. But alas and woe! The fulcrum of fortune has a way of seesawing from one condition to its opposite with no warning, like a sudden squall of an otherwise balmy day. It was all because of the messenger. Those of you who are familiar with the saying, "Don't blame the messenger," may protest. However, facts are facts, and no one ought to object if just this once the messenger is blamed, for indeed it was his fault. In a nutshell, not everyone is as honest as our dear Miss Lumley. The messenger's curiosity about the contents of the little box got the better of him, and he peeked. Once he saw the gem inside, his promise to deliver the box to the general's house by midnight was forgotten. The messenger had some urgent gambling debts of his own to pay, and he knew of a broker who bought valuable items for cash, no questions asked. This broker would not mind being awoken at midnight if there was some quick and profitable business at hand. Straight to the broker, the messenger dashed. Midnight came and went. At 1 o'clock in the morning, a square-jawed private arrived at the barracks, roused Captain Babushkinov, and informed him that the furious general had challenged him to a duel, pistols at dawn. The captain was mightily upset. He was upset that his sleep had been interrupted, and more upset to learn about the theft of the ring, but he was most upset about the duel. To get shot was a bad outcome, and so was shooting a general, so the thing was bound to end badly, no matter what. Madame Babushkinov insisted that the police be called. She had an eye for jewelry and was able to describe the stolen ring in perfect detail between bouts of tearful yelling.
"That thief of a governess!"
Thank goodness we still have our good name, which no one can ever take from us.
The always fascinating sound of grown-ups fighting soon woke the babushka-woos. The twins could not follow what was going on, but challenged the amused private to a duel by hurling their nightcaps at his feet. He had made his mother cry, an insult that could not go unanswered. Veronica eavesdropped more carefully, for she assumed all the shouting must have to do with her. Once she understood that no, it was because her governess had been exposed as a criminal, it was as if a weight had been lifted from her, and she began to think more clearly than before. Quietly and unnoticed by the others, she looked everywhere for the precious letter from the ballet. It was gone. She alone put Devar and Devar together, but she said nothing, for the grown-ups were still arguing about the ring and the jewel. Yet the discovery that there was no audition, had never been an audition, and would never be an audition, was such a jolt to her system that it caused her to have what is known as an epiphany. The exact nature of her life-changing insight was Veronica's business alone. Perhaps some day she would write her own book about it, just as that young Tolstoy fellow would write his. For now, it is enough to know that the girl smiled, yawned, and stretched like an ordinary child, not a dancer. Then she went back to bed, where she slept more soundly than she had in many months. As for the ring, the shady characters who dealt in stolen items were well known to the St. Petersburg police, and officers were dispatched to interview them all. It was now nearly 3 in the morning, and the particular broker we are concerned with was snoring in bed. But a policeman pounding on the door got him up again. He denied knowing anything about a ring with a green stone, a red stone, a polka dot stone, or any other type of stone, and made outraged protests about the late hour, the absurd accusation, the mud trampled on his clean floor by the policeman's dirty boots. The officers looked around, opening drawers, emptying closets, and making a dreadful mess. Eventually, they left, with a threat to return in the morning and search the whole place twice as thoroughly in the daylight. Now, painfully awake, the broker drank a strong black coffee and rued his change of fortune. A stroke of good luck had brought him a midnight visit from a debt-ridden messenger with a valuable ring. The desperate fellow had been glad to accept a tenth of the jewel's worth. Money was exchanged, and now the ring belonged to the broker. If he sold it for even half its value, what a profit he would make. But the tide of luck had already turned. There was no longer a chance of selling the ring for even a single kopeck without ending up in jail, not with the police already searching for it. What should the broker do? In such a predicament, many would fall prey to a mixed-up way of thinking called the sunk-cost fallacy, which is best explained by telling a brief story. Imagine you have been sent to sell your family's cow at the market, but instead you trade the cow for a handful of beans. If you happen to also imagine that your name is Jack, and you are a character in a fairy tale involving giants and magic beanstalks, that is entirely your business. Here is where the sunk-cost fallacy comes in. Fallacy means a mistaken belief, and sunk-cost means money that is already spent. Thus, the sunk-cost fallacy is the mistaken belief that the money you once paid for something has anything to do with what it might now be worth. In other words, a fistful of beans does not become valuable simply because you paid a cow for them. The cow is a sunk cost, and the beans must be taken on their own merits. Perhaps they are magic, perhaps not. Perhaps a beanstalk will grow to the clouds, and an adventure with giants will ensue. Or, perhaps, you will slurp a last bowl of watery bean soup and long for the days when your family owned a cow, from which you will get milk and soothing lowing and soft-eyed companionship, at least. The broker in stolen goods was a criminal, but he was also a businessman, and he knew all about the sunk cost fallacy. The money he had paid for the ring mere hours before sunk as a shipwreck at the bottom of the sea. The dream of great profits that had danced through his head as he slept, gone and forgotten.
He wasted no time whining about his losses or imagining there was some way to recapture the ring's value. Now, his only wish was to avoid getting carted off to jail. He put the ring in its box, woke up one of his own servants, and ordered the man to take the box back to the messenger who had brought it to him in the first place.
"But he'll be asleep,"
the servant goggily objected. He was none too pleased to be sent out at that hour himself.
"I don't care if he's dead. Wake him up,"
the broker ordered,
"and tell him to retrace his steps. He must take this worthless rock back to whoever he stole it from, right away, before we all end up in Siberia."
The broker's servant did as he was told. The hotel messenger was not asleep at all, but pacing his room in his night clothes. He had rid himself of his debts, which was good news. The bad news, he was so racked with guilt about stealing the ring that he had already decided to flee St. Petersburg at dawn and make a new life for himself elsewhere. But now the accursed box had returned. The sight of it struck fear in his heart.
"It is an albatross round my neck,"
he protested. But he also did as he was told. With his coat hastily thrown over his night clothes and his feet in slippers, he raced back to the hotel and left the box at the front desk, addressed it to the mysterious young lady in the royal suite, the unnamed cousin of England's queen. The next day he failed to report to work, and the day after as well. On the third day, the Grand Hotel replaced him with another, more trustworthy employee. What became of the poor fellow is another story, and would make a fine Russian novel, full of bad choices, pointless suffering, and lives ruined for no good reason. For now it is enough to say that his brush with thievery taught him much about crime and punishment, and the dangers of thinking that doing a wrong thing just this once makes it somehow less wrong. As Agatha Swanburn once said, "A conscience is like a treasure map. You must follow it to the very end if you wish to profit from it." What a night it had turned out to be. The back and forth of the emerald ring was enough to put one in mind of the children's game called Hot Potato, which has nothing to do with cooked spuds or even warm globes. Broadly speaking, a hot potato is an item that no one wants. The princess's emerald ring had become just such a potato. As a result, neither the Babushkinovs, nor the general and the square-jawed private who worked for him, nor the St. Petersburg police, nor the broker in stolen goods, his servant, or the hotel messenger, whose fault it all was, got much sleep. However, Miss Penelope Lumley snoozed through the whole business and knew nothing about it. Before dawn, she rose, put on her royal costume, and packed up her feathered carpet bag. Then she waited, ready to board whatever ship of luxury the hotel had found for her, and the sooner the better. At 6 o'clock sharp, there was a knock at her door. There stood a fresh-faced bellboy. Her first thought was that he looked barely older than Alexander Incorrigible.
"I have your flowers, Your Grace,"
the boy said, out of breath. The bouquet was so large, he could barely carry it.
"And your chocolates."
In all her weary play-acting, she had forgotten about ordering these things, but their arrival reminded her to get back in character, so to speak. She stepped aside so the boy might come in and set down the vase.
"Thank you. That is to say, tut-tut, the Cockney Flower Girls of London sell nicer flowers than these."
The boy gave her a receipt to sign for the items. In her haste, she signed P. Lumley. She realized her error at once, but thought it best not to make a fuss over crossing it out, as it would simply draw attention to the name, and she would soon be safely at sea in any case. After handing him his fountain pen and the receipt, she popped a whole chocolate in her mouth all at once, as she had often seen Lady Constance do.
"Now, young sir,"
she said with difficulty, for it turned out to be a gooey one with a sticky caramel center.
"I wish to know what time my ship leaves."
But the capable young man was already holding the ticket.
"It's right here, Your Grace,"
he said.
"Hmm,"
she replied, trying to sound displeased. She examined the ticket. First-class passage on the Royal Amsterdam, the finest Dutch clipper ship to sail the northern waters, leaving promptly at 10 o'clock. she could hardly have asked for better.
"Royal Amsterdam, ha! A mere tugboat," she scoffed. "I will endure it, I suppose, but I need a carriage to take me to the dock."
"Already arranged, my lady."
"Is that so?"
She forced herself to frown as she swallowed the last of the chocolate.
"In that case, have a hearty breakfast brought to my room. A bowl of hot porridge would hit the spot with a spoonful of jam. Why, what is that in your hand?" "This package was at the front desk for you."
Proudly he held out the little box.
"I'll see to your breakfast right away."
"Wait."
Penelope's fingers went cold as she opened the box. There was the emerald ring with the tissue paper carelessly crumpled around it.
"This was to be delivered to a general's house last night," she said,
handing it back to him.
"Clearly it was not. I should not have trusted that messenger."
The cheerful bellboy clicked his heels together in the Russian fashion.
"Shall I deliver it somewhere for you now, Your Grace?"
"I'm afraid it is too late. And no time for breakfast either. Blast!"
Hot porridge would have been lovely, but not today. No doubt all the police in St. Petersburg were looking for her, or soon would be. She grabbed her red velvet cloak and feathered carpet bag.
"I shall need that carriage at once."
"Your Grace, the ship doesn't sail until 10.
"Too late."
She was already striding down the hall. The bellboy scampered behind.
"But it is the only luxury passenger ship to leave today."
"Never mind luxury," she retorted. "I don't care what kind of ship it is. I must leave the city now. What is the very next vessel to leave St. Petersburg?"
The boy looked as if he might cry.
"I'm sorry. I don't know, Your Grace."
Poor child. She took pity on him and dropped her imperious tone.
"Of course you do not. How could you? You are not the harbour master after all. However, you are an excellent bellboy and will no doubt achieve great things in life if you apply yourself. For now, just get me to the street, but not through the hotel lobby, where we will be seen. Is there a side door? Through the kitchen, perhaps?"
The bewildered bellboy did as she asked. Before long, they had slipped out to the street through a service door. The boy put his fingers to his lips and whistled sharply to hail a carriage. The first to stop was not one of the fine carriages that picked up the hotel's wealthy guests, but a simple horse-drawn wagon, more suited to delivering goods to the kitchen. At the moment, the wagon was full of beets. Penelope clambered up next to the driver, as it was the only place to sit.
"Take me to the waterfront, right away," she said.
At the driver's blank look, she made swimming motions to no avail. The puzzled driver spoke to the bellboy in Russian and made concerned gestures toward his cargo. After a brief negotiation, the bellboy prevailed. He turned to Penelope.
"He wants to know which dock, Your Ladyship."
"Wherever I am likely to find a ship putting out to sea right now."
The boy translated. By now the sun had risen, and Penelope's fear made her impatient.
"Let's go, Arden 2-3,
she said to the driver. Obliging, he started the horse at a trot.
"But, Your Grace, the box!"
The bellboy broke into a run and chased after the moving wagon. With a strong overhead toss, he threw the box at Penelope. Countless games of playing hot potato with the incorrigible children had honed her reflexes. Without thinking, she caught the box with both hands.
"To be found with this emerald is the last thing I need,"
she exclaimed, and tossed it back to the bellboy. Determined, the boy threw it to the driver, in whose lap it landed. The annoyed driver shoved it at Penelope and kept his eyes on the road.
"Very well, but we must hurry."
She grabbed the reins and gave them a hard shake.
"Hiyah! Hiyah!"
she called to the horses.
"Now gallop!"
Obediently, the horses took off. Penelope was nearly knocked out of her seat. But there was a traffic jam not far ahead, and the driver cursed in Russian as he pulled the sweating team to a hard stop. An angry general waving a pistol was being pursued through the intersection by an even angrier pair of little Russian boys, who were in turn being pursued by their parents, a hysterical, well-dressed woman, and a tall, imposing captain with a bandage tied round his head, though the wound was clearly no more than a scratch.
"It is the Babushkinovs!" Penelope cried.
She jumped down from her seat into the wagon itself to hide among the beats. Alas, the wagon was a rickety wooden affair. The force of her landing was enough to split the boards in two.
Beats!
Madame Babushkinov cried in horror as the spilled beets tumbled in a river of red across the road. Penelope hung on to the railing with one hand and wedged her feet on either side of the split. The little box was in her other hand. Thinking quickly, she threw it high in the air.
"Hot potato!"
she cried to get their attention. The twins' heads whipped upward, searching.
"I have it!"
yelled Boris.
"I have it!"
yelled Konstantin, shouting over his brother. The twins raced to be first to catch the box, but the beets were rolling underfoot. At the same moment, the two boys flailed and tripped. Distracted by their cries, their mother also lost her balance on the sea of beets and ended up sprawled on her backside in the road, as a soaring emerald ring reached the top of its flight, paused, then dropped fantastically from the sky and landed in her lap. Penelope kept low and out of sight in the broken wagon. The spilled beets had stopped all the other traffic, and in the chaos and distraction, her driver had found an opening and gotten them through. She peeked between the wooden slats at the scene they were leaving behind. Madame Babushkinov held the ring aloft in triumph, as the confused general and her equally confused husband stood nearby.
"Ivan Viktorovich, look!"
she cried.
"Your mother's ring dropped from heaven itself! We have been saved! Saved by the beets!"
The rickety wagon turned down one street and then another. Penelope was still hanging on in the back and could not see where they were going, but they were surely heading toward the sea, for the smell of the cold salt air grew stronger by the minute. She drew a deep breath. The sea air was nourishing and gave her hope.
"My costume has been spoiled by all this rolling around in a beet wagon, and I no longer have the ring," she thought. "But a first-class ticket for the Royal Amsterdam will serve as proof of my wealthy connections. With it, I will easily convince some captain or other to take me on as a passenger."
The wagon stopped.
"Phew!" the driver exclaimed, holding his nose. Even the horses tossed their heads and snorted in distaste.
"If you mean that something smells fishy around here, I quite agree," Penelope said, climbing out.
The whole place stank of fish. A look at the vessels preparing to set sail revealed why. These were no luxury schooners. The beet wagon driver had taken her where the fishing boats berthed, for those were the very first boats to leave St. Petersburg each day.
"There has been an unfortunate misunderstanding," she said to the driver, "for these are all fishing boats, yet I am a passenger, not a fish, obviously. I wonder if you might possibly take me to a different dock?"
The driver glared and let out a stream of angry words in Russian. His meaning was along the lines of,
"Listen, princess, whoever you are, I brought you when you said you wanted to go. Now I expect to be paid for the ride, plus the cost of fixing my broken wagon. And don't forget about my lost beets. That's a sunk cost I can never get back."
Penelope understood not a word, but the fellow's tone was plain as day. And it was clear from the way he had kept slapping one open palm with the back of his other hand that he wanted money. She gave him a winning smile.
"Please submit your bill to the Grand Hotel of St. Petersburg to be charged to my account."
"Nyet,"
he roared, and took a threatening step toward her.
"My good sir, you shall be paid, I promise, but not just yet," she said,
and bolted. The driver shouted and shook his fist, but he could not give chase without leaving his horses, and after losing his beets, he had no wish to lose his animals as well. Penelope ran in a zigzag, ducking behind crates and heaps of coiled rope as she made her way to the ships. At the far end of the dock, a Norwegian trawler was being loaded with provisions.
"The incorrigibles would use their noses to discover what these wooden casks contain, and so can I. If I concentrate," she thought, sniffing her way along. "I smell fresh water, salt, hardtack, and sauerkraut, and all these empty barrels were once filled with..." She sniffed deeply to sort it out from the general fishy smell of the dock. "Not sole, not flounder, but herring, if I am not mistaken. Empty barrels! Eureka!"
She glanced about to make sure no one was watching, but the crew was hard at work, preparing to set sail. She pried the top off an empty barrel and began to climb in.
"One leg at a time, and never mind the dress, which is already ruined," she thought. "But, there is something inside this barrel after all. Perhaps if I give a small kick to dislodge the contents..."
"Ugh!"
cried the barrel, or rather, the man it contained. Penelope withdrew in a flash. The fellow stood with effort and blinked his eyes in the early morning light, for he had been hiding in the dark for an hour already. He stared at Penelope in horror.
"Albatross," he wailed. "The albatross has returned."
"I know you," Penelope gave him a hard look. "Aren't you the messenger from the Grand Hotel who was supposed to deliver that small box to a general's house? There has been a great deal of trouble because of you."
"Yes, it is all my fault," the messenger replied in despair, for indeed it was the same fellow. "I was in terrible debt, sick with worry, and when I saw that precious jewel, I lost my head. I never should have peaked. What a fool I was to think that committing a crime would improve my situation. Now I must flee St. Petersburg, or else die of shame."
His eyes filled with tears, but it might have been from the overpowering smell of herring.
"I have always had bad luck. I was born to cold, unhappy parents who preferred my brother to me. Later, I fell in with the wrong companions."
Penelope interrupted him. "This is no time for a Russian novel, sir. The ship will soon set sail, and two stowaways on board is one stowaway too many. I must ask you to leave." He started to protest, but soon gave up, since it was all his fault to begin with. Sadly, he climbed out of the barrel, like a hermit crab being evicted from a favorite shell. Fishy tears rolled down his cheeks. The man was Pessimax personified. Penelope could not help feeling sorry for him.
"Take heart, sir. Your luck is about to improve. Look."
She reached into her carpet bag and produced a ticket. He read it and his eyes grew wide.
"First-class passage of the Royal Amsterdam."
"It will be more comfortable than traveling in, one of these barrels, I assure you."
With a grunt, Penelope climbed in.
"The ship leaves at 10 o'clock. Let your actions be blameless until then. As Agatha Swanburn once said, anyone can be good for a minute. Multiply by 60 and the hours will take care of themselves. Now, if you will hand me my carpet bag..." "Thank you, and be so kind as to fasten the lid."
The messenger whose fault it all was bowed low, amazed how quickly one's life could change. He placed the lid on the barrel and ran off, clutching the precious ticket. And that is how Miss Penelope Lumley, so recently a guest in the royal suite of a hotel as grand as its name, gave away her first-class ticket on the Royal Amsterdam Clipper and became a stowaway on a Norwegian fishing ship, bound for who knows where, travelling in the least grand, dirtiest and most herring-scented accommodations imaginable. It had been a rough ride to board the ship. The barrel had been tipped on its side and rolled across a wooden ramp to the deck, then righted and lined up with all the others. During the ordeal, she had imagined herself as Edith Ann Pevington from the Giddy-Up Rainbow books she had loved so much as a child. Edith Ann's knack for breaking wild ponies to the saddle was demonstrated many times in the series, but there was always a great deal of bucking and kicking to endure. Once or twice, the fictional heroine was tossed off to land with her face in the fictional dirt. It was not exactly like being rolled in a barrel, but it was close enough to keep Penelope from panicking till the banging and tumbling were over. Now, somewhat recovered, she considered her options.
"It is only a matter of time before I am found out. Better to announce my presence than wait to be discovered," she decided. "But first, we must get far enough from shore that they would not consider turning back. Fishermen are honest, hard-working folk. I expect they will treat me fairly once they learn I am along for the ride, so to speak." And so she waited for an hour, or perhaps two. It was woefully uncomfortable. Worse, some feathers from her carpet bag had come loose and were floating around the barrel in time to her breath, threatening to make her sneeze. She fought the urge for as long as she could, but as Agatha Swanburn once said, the wise founder had a terrible head cold at the time,
"Sooner or later, every sneeze will have its day. Achoo! Achoo!
Penelope managed to wriggle one hand over her mouth, but it was too late. A moment later, the lid of the barrel was pried off, revealing a circle of blue sky that was instantly eclipsed by a man peering in. His pale complexion and round face would have made him a dead ringer for the man in the moon, if the moon had wispy blonde hair, bright blue eyes, and a puzzled expression. He blurted some strong words of surprise in his native tongue. Soon a whole constellation of faces appeared, all looking down at Penelope. "Good morning," she said.
"Good morgen,"
the moon-faced man replied. The rest laughed. Penelope tried to stand, but her legs had fallen asleep. As she flailed, several strong arms reached into the barrel to help. With their aid, she rose like a jack-in-the-box, swaying unsteadily as her eyes adjusted to the light.
"Good morning,"
she spoke more confidently now that she was upright and could breathe properly.
"I am on your boat quite by accident, for which I apologize. We shall have to make the best of it."
Before her stood a dozen men with fair, red-cheeked complexions and eyes in a permanent squint. They were dressed in work pants and thick knitted sweaters and caps. A few wore bibbed overalls made of oilcloth. All were blonde and tall and broad-shouldered as Vikings.
"I would like to speak with your captain."
She reached up to nudge her bent tiara back in place. It had taken quite a beating in the barrel.
"Tell him that a close relative of England's queen is aboard this...
She glanced at the weather-worn decks, the mended sails and seaweed-encrusted ropes, and, of course, the sting of fish was everywhere, but she thought it best to be polite.
"This fine, seaworthy vessel."
The men must have understood at least some of her meaning, for they began talking excitedly among themselves.
"Captain Ja! Captain Strom!"
they agreed. Two lifted her out of the barrel as if she weighed no more than the air, and they gently guided her with their rough hands and tattooed forearms as she took one wobbly landlubber's step after another to the captain's cabin. Captain Rolf Strom was a man of few words who worked fiercely hard for a living. He knew the value of money, which is to say, he knew exactly how many tons of herring he and his men had to draw from the sea every week in order to make a profit. The idea of trying to get something for nothing offended him to the core, and he made this very clear.
"Stow away,"
he pointed at Penelope. Then he ran his finger across his throat. Penelope gulped, adjusted her rumpled velvet cloak, and tried once more to convince the captain, through pantomime and whatever words in English or French he seemed to recognize, that she was not a stowaway precisely, but more of an accidental passenger, and that the Queen of England would pay generously for her safe passage home. But Captain Strom was not born yesterday, as the saying goes. He knew a liar when she was sitting in front of him, wrapped in a filthy piece of stage curtain and balancing a broken costume crown on her head.
"We no go to England," he said. "We go where fish go."
"A small detour?" she begged.
"The fish," he said, leaning back in his chair, "do not catch themselves."
His reply had the pithy wisdom of Agatha Swanburne, and who could argue? Luckily for Penelope, back on land, Captain Strom was the doting father to a houseful of tall, strong-limbed daughters, and it was not in his great Nordic heart to toss her overboard. He would provide his accidental passenger with a private bunk, as she was the only female on board, but otherwise she would enjoy the same creature comforts that he and his crew did, which is to say, none. Her bed was a thin blanket spread across a wooden shelf. Her tattered dress was no match for the bolstery winds at sea. She was given a spare set of cabin boys' clothes that were only a little too large for her, a pair of wide-legged cotton duck trousers, and a thick knitted sweater and cap, just as the crew wore. If not for these, she would have been chilled to the bone.
"The way royal ladies are expected to dress is terribly inconvenient," she thought, once she had changed into this warmer and far more comfortable uniform. "I wonder how Queen Victoria manages it. I do hope she gets a day off now and then, and can run about playing with the dogs on the lawn in sensible footwear and a warm hat."
After a bit of practice, walking in trousers, which she rather liked once she got used to it, she ventured on deck.
"Alf!"
one of the sailors barked. Soon others did the same.
"Alf! Alf!"
Worried, she glanced at the sky to see if the moon was full. Was this ship also under some sort of wolf curse? But it turned out the first mate's name was Alf. Everyone was afraid of the captain, who said little, but all the sailors liked Alf. He was one of the few aboard who had learned a bit of English during his travels, although his favourite word seemed to be nope. He greeted Penelope with a friendly smile.
Nope,
he said by way of greeting. He managed to introduce himself and the others and compliment her on her uniform.
Nice pants,
he said, patting his own. For now Penelope was dressed like the rest of the crew. Alf, she said, once she realized they could converse. Can you tell me the name of this ship? The other men had gone back to swapping out the dories, stacking them neatly one inside the next. There, the little rowboats would sit like Russian nesting dolls until morning came, and it was time to fish once more.
Nope,
he said, and added,
I cannot.
To Penelope's ear, it sounded like, I cannot. She frowned, for to give an answer of, I cannot, when asked a direct question, struck her as rude.
I beg your pardon, she said firmly, but if I am going to be sailing among you, surely you can tell me the name of the ship.
Alf explained her question to the others, who performed their answer as a charade. They made little squirrel faces, nibbling away with imaginary buck teeth, while holding their paws, that is to say, hands, in front of them.
Eganot,
Alf said, gesturing to his men.
What acorn eat?
Acorn?
Penelope repeated. Do you mean squirrels and acorns? It took a bit more nibbling, whisker-stroking, and tail-twitching to establish that by acorn, the fisherman meant squirrel, while acornot seemed to be the Norwegian word for acorn.
Acorn! That is a curious name for a ship, she said, but the name pleased her all the same, since it reminded her of home.
That night she struggled to find a comfortable position in which to sleep. Imagine the luxurious cruise she might have taken if not for that foolish messenger. All those tasty, chef-prepared meals, the well-appointed stateroom, the soft, silk-sheeted bed. Instead, here she was on the good ship Acorn, in a bunk that was as small and hard as a nutshell, and not nearly as cozy as a squirrel nest in the treetops would be. But then she thought of Nutsawoo, and her heart swelled. Any discomfort would be worth getting back to Ashton Place. As soon as she was able, she vowed to give his tiny, not-too-bright head as many head-scratches as he or she wanted. And some tasty acornuts, too. The 10th Chapter. Nothing is more sea-like than the sea. Dear old Nutsawoo, no doubt you, too, have wondered about the goings-on in the treetops of Ashton Place as that dim-witted rodent prepares for the great adventure in store. To raise children is no joke, for one never knows how they will turn out. Some children are raised by wolves and still manage to acquire kind hearts and excellent table manners. Others are given every advantage, doting parents, a splendid dacha in which to spend the summer months, a scholarship to the best schools in St. Petersburg, and yet grow up to be shady brokers in stolen goods, or hotel messengers of dubious morals. As Miss Charlotte Mortimer once told her favourite pupil,
"No one's fate is written in Indian ink." It is up to each of us to decide what sort of person we wish to become, which raises the questions. Was Nutsawoo eagerly looking forward to having a nestful of baby squirrels to raise? Was the expectant rodent determined to be the very best squirrel parent possible?
It is pleasant to think so, but frankly it is hard to tell what is in a squirrel's mind, unless it is autumn. In which case, the answer is acornuts, acornuts, and more acornuts. As for that other parent-to-be, Lady Constance Ashton, normally she was the sort of person whose thoughts flew out of her mouth willy-nilly, whether anyone was listening or not. But on the topic of her own impending motherhood, she had said little. Still, anyone whose life is in the midst of great change needs a trusted friend to confide in. In the days since the hiring of Mrs. Elsinore Penworthy, the two ladies had formed a deep, womanly bond. On sunny afternoons, they strolled arm in arm through the daffodils, which were already at the peak of cheerful yellow bloom.
"I wonder why the daffodils blossom first and the tulips come after," Lady Constance observed on one of their walks. "Is it the same every year, or do they take turns? If I were a tulip, I think I would tire of always being second."
"Perhaps the tulips prefer to come last," Mrs. Penworthy replied. "In the theatre, it's the star of the show who takes the final bow. And it's the last bite of cake that's the sweetest, don't you think?"
"Quite so, Mrs. Penworthy. Dessert is the best part of any meal."
When feeling playful, Lady Constance liked to draw out her friend's name in a sing-song voice that started in a high pitch and dropped to a low one. As she did so, now,
"Miss Penworthy,
do you think I will make a good mother?"
"Of course you will, dear," the tall, broad-shouldered baby nurse replied. "You'll take to it like a duck takes to water. Speaking of which, look at this dreadful mud puddle from all that spring rain we've had. You mustn't step in that. It'll ruin your pretty shoes. Let me give you a lift, won't you, Lady C?"
"Certainly. Whee!"
she cried merrily, as Simon effortlessly scooped up her pregnant bulk and carried her over the puddle, as if she weighed no more than a feather.
"You are so wonderfully strong, Mrs. Penworthy. I expect it's from so many years of carrying babies around."
"Sure, Lady C, that's the reason why,"
the baby nurse said, chuckling, and so their stroll continued. That Mrs. Penworthy was really Simon Harley Dickinson in disguise was known only to the incorrigible children. Mrs. Clark, whose closet had supplied much of his, that is to say, her wardrobe, and old Timothy, who always seemed to know the truth of what was going on at Ashton Place. Otherwise, the sprawling household went about its business and took the newcomer at face value. Lady Constance certainly did. When the weather was too cool or wet to walk outside, they sat in the baby's room, knitting. Lady Constance had never knitted before, nor had Simon, but his knowledge of sailor knots was vast, and he quickly realized that knitting was simply rows of knots hitched together on needles. Soon he was an absolute whiz at it, while Lady Constance dutifully knitted a baby hat one slow stitch at a time. Simon whipped together sweaters, scarves, and mittens for everyone in the household, blankets for the baby's crib, and baby clothes galore. The incorrigible children were thrilled when they found out "For Learn to Knit" was on the to-do-a-woo list, and now that Master Gogolev was gone, they had all the free time in the world. Poor Master Gogolev. As you might imagine, he never recovered from his terrifying encounter with the ghost of librarian past. His nerves were shot. He could no longer drag himself upstairs to the nursery. In fact, he could scarcely get out of bed. Finally, and with some pointed encouragement from Mrs. Clark, who had had quite enough of his ceaseless demands and complaints, he asked Lord Frederick if he might take a long restorative holiday abroad, at a spa.
"All right, but stay away from tar pits. That's my advice," Lord Frederick had said in reply.
Gogolev left on the next train. What became of him afterward, we may never know. Perhaps someday he was once again able to enjoy a piece of toast without weeping. Perhaps his horror of librarians also faded in time. We can only hope, for after all, few things are more enjoyable than a snack of tea and toast while curled up with a library book. As for the incorrigible's desire to join in the knitting, at first Lady Constance protested, for she still held strong opinions about what a bad influence the Wolf children would be on her own child. Mrs. Penworthy did not argue the point, but merely said,
"Well, for now that's not a worry, since your wee little Ashton isn't born yet, and the children do want to make presents for the baby. Presents, isn't that sweet?"
"I suppose so," Lady Constance answered, unsure.
The three Ashton wards did seem harmless at the moment. as Alexander and Beowulf helpfully wound tangled skeins into neat balls of yarn, while Cassiopeia used her abacus to calculate how many stitches to cast on for baby-sized booties and bibs. Mrs. Penworthy actually seemed to like the incorrigibles, and Lady Constance trusted her new friend's opinion more than anyone's, except Frederick's, of course. Too, Lady Constance was terribly fond of presents, and she imagined her baby would be as well. For who doesn't like presents? In this quiet way, a change in the lady's thinking took place. Not all at once, with shouted arguments and big to-do, but in the more usual way people change, bit by bit, starting with a tiny, acorn-sized willingness to try something new, followed by patient repetition, until what once was so uncomfortably foreign and strange no longer feels strange at all. Soon it was commonplace to find the five knitters peacefully gathered in the baby's room, needles click-clacking away. During these days, Madame Ionesco kept to herself. Simon said it was partly because she was working baker's hours. She baked bread all night and slept during the daytime, but mostly to do with her preparations for the first full moon in May.
"It's highly mysterious, I know, but she won't say more than that," he told the children.
They longed to see their spooky friend, but all in good time, for now there was a fresh basket of superb bread every morning, no Gogolev moping about, and countless baby presents to knit. Best of all, their dear friend Simawoo was close by, in two equally lovable versions, if you counted Mrs. Penworthy, which, of course, they did. If only Lumawoo could come back, then everything would be perfect. The acorn was built for fishing, not travel. It went out empty and came back when the hold was full, after weeks or even months at sea. Everyone aboard worked, and the work lasted all day, every day, from the hour when the pink light of dawn crept over the horizon to well past nightfall, when the stars shone softly in the half-lit sky and moonlight danced over the water. Penelope expected that she too would be put to work. She did not mind, for she had been raised to be useful. She would mend all those knitted sweaters or patch a torn sail. She could embroider pocket handkerchiefs for the crew, although these down-to-earth fellows might be just as glad to wipe their noses on their sleeves.
"I could give lessons in any number of subjects," she thought, "but not poetry. There are simply too many poems about shipwrecks, which would hardly be suitable, given the circumstances."
But when she asked Alf about a job, he only said, "Nope." It was just as well, for she was so seasick at first she could barely stand. By the third day, she had gotten her sea legs, which meant she felt queasy only part of the time. That afternoon, she ventured on deck for some air, and Captain Strom himself approached her. They had not spoken since their first interview, which Penelope chalked up to him being busy and perhaps shy. Never mind the fact that she did not speak Norwegian. He towered over her, taller even than Captain Babushkinov. The skin across his cheekbones was cracked and reddened from a life spent outdoors, and his eyes were blue as glacier ice. "Pay," he said, and held out his hand. There is a brutal honesty at sea. There are things that float and things that sink. And no amount of talk can change one to the other, or persuade a sail to fill when there is no wind. 3 days aboard ship had already weakened Penelope's capacity to lie. She mumbled her threadbare story about being the cousin of England's queen, but her heart was not in it, and she fell silent. Strom stood before her, implacable as the tides.
"Bay," he said, "or fish?"
"Fish?" she said weakly, for the idea of baiting a hook made her queasy all over again. "But surely there are other jobs I could do, and the Queen of England will cover any expense."
"Queen? Ah, ah," he said, and strode away.
Moments later he returned with a fishing pole, which he placed in her hands like a scepter.
"Queen of fish."
Penelope soon grew to like fishing. In fact, she found that she liked nearly everything about life aboard ship. It was orderly and full of purpose, much like the Swanburn Academy. If Swanburn had been a boat full of Norwegian fishermen instead of a school full of poor bright females. She found comfort in the tidiness of the ship, the casks of salt lined up like obedient dogs, and the empty, scrubbed-out dories that were hoisted aboard at the end of each day's work and neatly stacked, waiting for the dawn to come. Everyone had a task to do and a place to be. Each morning, the men set out in the dories to cast their nets into the